Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
It's the Shortcode Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Etler, and what better way to celebrate the end of a grueling semester than by sitting around with Nathan Miller, Cole Chaney, Greg Woods, and Casey McClear.
Good afternoon, Dave.
I can't say your name, Casey.
That's my name. It's not that hard.
Casey McClear.
Hey, before we start today's show, listeners, be sure to head over to our website at theshortcode.com and fill out our student tech survey so we can do a show soon about the technology you use in medical school to help you not flunk.
It's our best episode.
Hasn't happened yet.
But it happened last year.
It did.
It was so good.
It got a lot of... It seemed to be helpful for people. And the way to make it helpful is to actually gather some data. So that's why we have this student tech survey thing on our website. So go take a look. Won't take you long.
And I'm sure it's changed from last year. All the apps are updated. And yeah. There's a whole new way to look at it.
There's a whole pod of us with Surface Pro 3s.
Yeah, so the Surface Pro 3 seems to be... I ran into another med student. I was asking her about it, and she said that that this device is starting to take over medical school.
I love it so much. Well, part of the appeal is that you can have two windows open on the same screen next to each other, so I can, like, be typing up things from my notes, like, answering the like main points of the lecture in one window and have it up on the other one, or have the internet open looking something up while I'm also taking notes and like trying to make connections there.
And it's only twice as much as a base level iPad, so bargain.
But it does so much more.
It's also a laptop.
Yeah, you have the tablet and laptop features. You can take your exams on it even, which is wonderful. Versus having my system, which is iPad and computer. But we can discuss all this on the tech podcast.
Yes, it's a teaser.
Yeah.
What you can expect. So we're at the end of the semester. In fact, this episode will come out
in 2015.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think so.
When's
a
the
week,
first?
A week after the 25th.
Yes. So so let's talk about the semester.
New Year's Day
just passed. Wow! Everybody will be hungover when they listen to the show. What went well for you guys this semester? I mean, is there anything that you can look back on that said, you know, what I did went really well?
So I'm an M. This is Cole. I realize we don't have facial recognition out there. I'm an M2 semester one, and that's traditionally one of the tougher semesters. And I think I figured out my memory much better than I have in the past.
Do tell.
I figured out that all this detail work I think I was putting in early in the week really wasn't staying. And then all the foundational work I was trying to get in the last couple of days would be too late.
Oh.
And so I embraced staying up much later and doing the detail work the night before the test, even the morning of the test as study time. And this was something so against my undergraduate philosophy on studying and preparation. But this new form of learning and this new form of testing sort of required it.
So you're saying that the foundational stuff in the beginning of the week, I mean, it kind of makes sense once you think about it.
Yeah.
But, and then the sort of, what, the details of it in the latter part of the week?
I think I was trying to do this long-term memorization strategy. You know, if I really ingrain it, I'll really know it well. But there's just such a sheer volume that some of it you just have to rely on that super short-term memory. And so I actually found myself picking up a lot of points, maybe learning stuff 2 hours before the exam, which is so... That's so against what I've learned in the past about test-taking.
Is that more or less stressful for you?
It's a little more stressful, but also I think the pressure sort of makes you sharp. It worked, so that's the one thing, I guess, for me.
The crucible of studying.
Well, it's really important.
Yeah, and I used to really think, oh, those people stay up all night for a test, that's nuts. The people study before the test an hour before, they need to just be relaxing, maybe drinking coffee. And that went out the window this semester, and that actually helped a lot.
If I was answering this question, it would probably go something like this. So when I was an undergrad, I did no studying at all, and that didn't work very well. And now I figured out that I had to actually study.
Like hindsight, right? Now you know.
Anybody else have something that worked particularly well this past fall, or that you feel particularly good about?
I don't know if I would say. Well, I'm sure it helped me. I probably got more sleep this semester than I did all of undergraduate. So
that's good.
Well, I didn't sleep very much. I slept an unreasonably small amount in undergraduate. So
I was gonna say normally that's backwards. I feel like to what most people would say.
I know.
What do you attribute that to?
I took a year off and I figured out my work-life balance, and I spent a whole year learning to relax. And I actually had to teach myself how to relax. And I think that has been very helpful. And even though I've definitely been stressed at times, I feel nothing like the people running around like chickens with their heads cut off kind of thing, I feel much more relaxed and much more able to accept that even when I don't get, like, a perfect score, that's okay. It doesn't make me a bad doctor, a bad person.
So the other question I wanted to ask in relation to this is, will you be able to sustain these things? I mean, you know, one thing I heard from somebody a while back, and I can't remember it during, you know, it was on the show, was that every semester seems to bring a different technique. Mm-hmm. Is that
yeah, I mean, like you, it's almost like it's not totally different. You can still learn from it, but I think that's very true. When you look at the differences in class load and class variety moving through the different semesters, going even from first semester of second year to second is a big difference, because first semester I think the big bulk of the craziness is farm for a lot of people, but then the second semester is FCP 4, which is Foundations of Clinical Practice 4, and that's kind of, as I viewed it, a class that really prepares you for step one, and that is, it's not, you know, the list of drugs and all this stuff about it, but it's the sheer bulk of the class, and that you're having several lectures of it a day. They're all, I think, good cases in teaching you management of your time and management of all that you have to go through, but it's a little bit different between them.
I think that'll also be different for the M1s now, because speaking as an M1, I have no idea what classes you're talking about.
Oh, that's true, because that curriculum changed. So yes, I don't really know what that's, you know, what that's going to do, but I think it remains valid that each semester is a little bit different, because each class is going to bring with it a different set of challenges, whether it's learning the details, that's whether true. It's managing the volume of it all. You always need to be kind of adapting a little bit.
I think you're onto something with that.
And then they turn on its head third and fourth year, right? I mean, that's a totally different, totally separate learning. So, I mean, really, it validates what you're saying in that it just keeps getting progressively more different, maybe more or less challenging, depending on your learning style.
And that's, people would always ask me, you know, well, what's been the most difficult, you know, semester of medical school? Or is this the most difficult? And I'd say, well, they're all different. They're difficult in their own way. There is no clear-cut winner for me. You know, the second year is, I would say, easily the roughest of the first two, but in its current form, that is. Otherwise, yeah, they're different. It's tough to say.
Well, I think the biggest thing that helped me personally, if I had to put my finger on one thing, I would say going back to early semester, we had a podcast discussing IME. That was a great foundation for me. It made transition into this semester.
So this is the Introduction to Medical Education at Iowa.
That is correct. Thank you for clarifying all that.
Yeah, no, that's not
the
what I'm here
summer
for.
Course.
The summer program where the summer program where people who may have, I mean, they might, basically, if they feel like they need an extra leg up to get the foundations laid, they can take part in this.
I did it as well.
It's designed for primarily for non-traditional students, although I personally graduated this past May and took it this summer. So it just kind of depends on your background. It was extremely useful if you're coming to Iowa. I definitely recommend at least looking into it. Like I said, it was great foundational stuff for this semester and just really made that transition smooth. Semester went great. I think I was probably a little less stressed to start out, like first half of the semester or so, where a lot of people were trying to figure out what to do. I was just kind of cruising along still because I'd been doing it all summer.
Nice.
It sounds like it wouldn't be fun to be studying all summer, but you know about your classmates and things. It's really cool. While that in itself is not sustainable into the future, I'm not going to have an IME for second semester, I think getting those core things down really solid prior to starting the first semester will carry over into the rest of my medical education.
So what didn't go well? What would you change about this past semester? Nothing. You guys are like, nope,
no,
nailed it.
I had a couple, I wrote them down. So
totally nailed it.
I always have a lot. I noticed a couple of times I would have these freakout moments. This has a silver lining, this lesson. For example, we have to grow UTIs in the Principles of Infectious Disease class, right? So you grow
urinary tract infection.
Yeah, you grow the UTI.
You grow the bacteria that causes it.
Yeah.
I have done that before.
That's a very important distinction.
I use words to communicate with language. I think culture is actually.
Can you imagine like walking into class and
culture,
like, guys, I did it. I have a UTI.
I got a UTI.
At least it's a UTI, not an STI, because that'll get awkward.
Come
real
take
fast.
A look.
I mislabeled some things, and ultimately, there's a stiff punishment for this in terms of points, because the thought is, you know, as a doctor, you can't be misordering labs or putting in, you know, you need to be very accurate. And that's actually a very valid point. I like freaked out and I felt very upset about it. And I think I sort of, the next 3 days, I was like, ugh, just it like haunted me. Mm-hmm. And then when I finally like let it go, rested, then the teacher reached out, hey, you know, let's talk about working through this. Let's see if we can recoup some points. Let's see if we can make this a learning experience. And so it was like the second I let it go, that's when it sort of got, and like that was a big thing I think this semester is that didn't went well, is I'd get hung up on maybe a bad test, a bad experience, and every time I let them go it seemed to actually turn out just fine.
I feel like that's going to be one of those lessons that you can consistently apply for the rest of your training and probably for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Because there's not going to be any situation that you find yourself in anymore where you know you can afford to dwell unproductively on your mistakes. You know, you just learn from them. You just have to figure out a way to learn from them. And I totally understand, you know, like the post mistake freak out and like being totally down on yourself or something. But that's not a that doesn't help. It doesn't help anything.
It doesn't fix anything.
Yeah.
And you actually hurt yourself more.
The curriculum train does not stop self-pity.
It's not going to pause.
That's a good point, though. Yeah, I know. So as soon as you get hung up on one thing, then you miss four others, then it becomes a cycle. And that's a great point.
Yeah, and then you're like freaking out studying all weekend, and you're miserable, and you haven't slept, and you haven't seen your friends, and like it's just not good.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else have anything that they would like to have changed? Well, what do you plan to do in 2015 to add to your study of medicine? So
I'd like to gear down a little bit, Dave, actually. I'm at capacity. I'd really like to take it down.
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities that you can... Yes.
Why do I have to add things?
I was thinking more of, you know, the co-curricular things that you can do. You know, like the things like global programs or research. Well, Cole's already done research.
I did research.
A lot. And
I'd like to do more.
Okay, it's cool.
I would encourage... I think the M1s have the more exciting opportunities. So that's the one thing is I'll always push that the research... the getting out in the clinic. So, you know, I got to go out to Betty Ford. It was really cool. A lot of people around here were doing the, what's the summer program here that you go out and you work in? MECO. This awesome program where you go work in Muscatine, Iowa at a hospital and basically do everything with the doctor. I mean, do you guys have any interest in that?
I think MECO's definitely very interesting. I'm personally leaning towards doing research probably. This past week, I've been meeting with some faculty discussing research opportunities, and I thought I'd be like, I'm not sure if I'd like any of them, but then I ended up liking like everything that I've talked about. So now it comes down to like whittling it down to something that I am really passionate about for the summer. But it's exciting. There's all this stuff going on here, and the college really supports research activities as well as clinical if you want to do MECO or even just shadowing or things like that. So transitioning into that research or mixing that and maybe even starting this spring semester will be different for me since this semester I pretty much just focused on the coursework. I'd like to kind of be more balanced educational-wise, I guess. Educationally.
And I know a lot of people that did MECO, and there's so many good reviews of it. They've had so many incredible experiences. And like you said, it's these smaller places throughout Iowa, so you're not necessarily going to be in a bigger city. So you get a little bit of an experience of rural health as well.
Did we define this well enough at this point? MECO. Medical?
I'll look it up.
Yeah, thank you.
You
but anyway, the program is you go out into you know various areas around Iowa, and you work with community healthcare providers, you know, physicians around the state to help them deliver care. And it's basically an opportunity for you to get your feet wet. And I think you probably said a little bit of that.
Medical education and community orientation.
Sure, there we go. That's it.
Yeah.
And Iowa prides itself on that.
Yeah.
Primary care going. I mean, this is what they do well here. And so I think why not sort of.
Yeah,
and given the makeup of the state,
programs.
Too. Yeah. Yep.
Who was most important or helpful to you this semester? Or who or what, actually?
I got to do a shout out for my mother because she came and helped me clean my apartment, do laundry a couple times when I was really. She lives in Des Moines, drove out, and that's a...
Like, hear that, Mom?
Yeah,
Mom?
We all have that one test period block month that's just crazy, and that is huge. And realistically, you could probably take an hour and do it all yourself, but there's something about having that person there with you, holding your hand.
When you're like spinning around going, I don't know what to do first.
Yeah.
Or just rocking in the corner, crying a little bit.
It's hilarious. I mean, I think you probably could have enough time for everything. It's just the perception of the lack of time is right. The bigger issue than the time itself, mm-hmm. I think. Do you get a sense for that?
Yeah, I mean, you would have to not stop. I mean, there are sometimes when I get home from classes and I'm like, I'm just exhausted. If I had like an anatomy lab that went till 6 and I get home and I'm just like, I can't
you
even
smell
cook
bad.
For myself and I can't take a shower and I can't do anything. But I have the whole night when there's nothing... to mm-hmm. be done and I can't do anything.
This explains why. This explains how emaciated and smelly you've been.
Hey, step off.
So I would say downtime is probably
one of
those things that was most helpful this semester because I guess I'd heard that from some upperclassmen coming in, so I tried to set aside time, kept doing, like, sports stuff, like, at least, like, one day a week, you know, things like that, at least when it was nice out, and just doing that with my classmates as well, made it a lot of fun. We'd study together, like, go out and play together, basically. Yeah.
I'm a huge advocate for that, because last year, in when I was going through the M2 year, it was pretty awful a lot of the time. So one thing that I had to try to do and try to convince myself is that taking some time off can be just as important, if not more important, than getting, you know, getting this much done in this much amount of time. Because what you start to realize, and whether or not you know this when you're doing it, I don't know, but I didn't for a long time, but if you try to push through and you're sleepy or you're not retaining stuff, that 15 minutes that you just spent trying to push through it, was it really more helpful than if you just took some time off, you know, looked at something else, looked out a window or closed your eyes for a few minutes or you know, went and did some dishes or some laundry or something like that? And I think what I found is that over time, that downtime does make a big difference, both in terms of how sane you're able to keep yourself, but also to break up the monotony and to make you more productive, which seems counterintuitive when you think about it, but and it did to me for a long time when I first started to try to make that a point for myself. But in the end, you do realize that can make a big difference.
They keep telling us that, but I think you really have to just suck it up and try it before it really sinks in.
Yeah, you have to realize, learn it.
Oh, they yes. were right. Yeah. Like all those times they've been telling me that, they had a point.
Mm-hmm.
Have you figured that out on your own, do you think? I mean, do we really have to say it?
I don't know. I mean, you're hearing it from us now, so that's important. Take that to heart, I think.
There's a lot of pressure to just be on all the time.
Sure, yeah.
And if you're not, to act like you are. We have a friend here who sometimes she'll just walk up and say, like, struggle, 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 struggle. Mm-hmm. And everyone echoes it back at her because, like, we know what she's going through at any particular time. We're like, yeah, struggle, struggle, struggle. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. That's really been a good thing for our friend group, I think. Like, we all feel each other's pain, like, when it gets tough. And we know we're not alone.
And getting through finals, like we just did a while back, I think those times that you're able to take off allow you to approach the times when you can't a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're pacing yourself throughout the normal year, when you finally reach that point in finals when you say, all right, you know, I really do need to keep powering on through this, it makes it a little bit more culpable to do that as opposed to, you know, having done that for the past 3-4 months and saying, well, I'll keep this up for another week until these tests are done.
Personally, I almost found finals, like leading up to finals, more difficult because it was harder to take that time off, you know, because throughout the semester mm-hmm. I've been taking like maybe a day a week off or something like that. And then going into finals, I'm like, well, I got like 5 tests in 2 weeks or something. So it's hard to schedule that, find that day that I can take off. And so you're right, it makes a big difference. I was feeling a dragon on Thursday mm-hmm. night.
Psychologically speaking, willpower is like a muscle. You exercise it and it gets tired and you have to rest before you can use it again. Oh, but I would like to say my bearded dragon is a beautiful person, creature, has gotten me through the semester. I got a bearded dragon at the beginning of the semester and I'm deeply in love with it and it sits on my belly and we rewatch lectures together.
I thought that was like when someone, you call someone a unicorn. I thought like that was you were describing a person.
Bearded dragon, and I feed
he's my bearded dragon. She's my bearded dragon.
But I am gonna go home and tell my boyfriend that.
Cole Chaney is my bearded dragon.
Not so bearded now, yeah. But
unbearded,
less bearded
in spirit.
Thank you for that. What was the most shocking thing that happened, good or bad?
I had a cell phone go off in a simulated patient interview situation. And I was a little, again, one of my more upsetting things. And when I got done, we had the review, and it's worth points. It was a final. Ooh. And I said, the cell phone. And they said, what cell? Like, I don't know if they were hard of hearing or if this was like, because I heard on, it was a very subtle, like, chime.
Was it like an email thing? It's not like somebody was calling you.
It was like, it was a very just,
ba-ding,
ding. Yeah. But like, and there's a lot of action and motion. And so to this day, I don't know if the person was like being nice or
just messing with you.
Messing with me. I don't, it was never discussed, never. And I was like, because I went and talked to administration, like, hey, this happened. Like, I'm so sorry. I just, like, I wanted to fess up to it. And the person was like, we didn't hear anything. There's nothing. So I don't know if it just, maybe it was in my head, perhaps.
You're so noble.
Was there a video of this? Because usually they record our.
There was video, and so it's like, it was kind of fuzzy. So you can't really.
Mysterious.
It's like Bigfoot of the cell phone ring. So this was very shocking to me. And also, it was nice that I felt like, you know, there's very little margin for error, but I felt like there was a bit of forgiveness here if the. In fact, that's what happened.
I think people are paying less and less attention to cell phones going off in the wrong circumstances. Yeah.
So think about like when you were maybe in elementary. So Dave, you might not have experienced this. We had cell phones towards the end of our high school career.
Yes.
I think that was a pretty big deal if that went off, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gone. It's in the teacher's desk.
I got dinged on a yearly review several years ago for having my cell phone going off in meetings. And I don't know. I feel like since then that has changed.
Wow.
Yeah. A little bit. I mean, here's the thing. If I turn off my cell phone, it's not going to get turned on again. And that's a problem.
Yeah. And then when you do, you've missed all this stuff and you're going, oh no.
My wife is trying to get in touch with me.
Yeah,
my
something terrible's happened.
Sick at school. You know,
Was it a ringing or a vibrating they were upset with?
Oh, no, the ring.
Okay, the ring is kind of like, I could see, like, turn that off maybe.
Shut up, Cole.
There's also.
Why are you haunting him with his mistake?
It's better now, Cole. Nobody pays attention to cell phones. That's what I tell myself.
It's ubiquitous.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine Podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back on the Short Code Podcast.
All right, I've got a story. So I don't know if you guys are aware, but prior to starting medical school, I worked, and I guess still technically do occasionally, as a paramedic doing pre-hospital emergency medicine. So I have like a passion for emergency medicine, especially in the pre-hospital variety. There's a story this past week about Houston. I'm not sure if it was their fire department or independent EMS agency, but they're initiating a program where they go to houses and do what's called community paramedicine. So instead of patients, it's primarily focused on their frequent flyers, the patients who call all the time, and text the like the EMS system and the ERs. They'll go out and just do like almost regular checkups on these folks or follow-ups after they've been to the ER to verify everything's going all right and hopefully put less stress on the system when basically everyone else is busy. They do all sorts of things like health screenings. They can check on meds and things like that. This whole idea is pretty much brand new in the field of pre-hospital emergency medicine, but I want to see what you guys have to think about that. You know, when you've got, you know, people who have, it's not a ton of training, but, you know, some training for sure, but they're not even going to the ER for minor things, you know?
So this is, I mean, they're showing up at people's, I mean, they have a list of clients, basically.
That's right.
And, you know, they go and check up on them. They, you know, take their vitals. They counsel them on their management of diabetes, for instance.
Make sure they're getting like follow-up appointments scheduled, things like that.
That's pretty cool.
I love it.
I love this thought. The emergency medicine, I think anytime you're, before you get in the world of medicine, you see emergency medicine, you think like George Clooney and like ER, right? And then when you get into it, you realize the bigger function is this triage system that we build, because this is the intake valve of the hospital, and then, you know, they're the ones that direct everything from there, and so they're not actually maybe doing a ton of pen tube trachea surgeries, right? Yep. They're doing a lot more of directing people to where they need to get. Yep. This is a cool way to sort of change the stopper on the system or widen the valve a bit, to say.
And this feels very public healthy to me as well. And given that I'm doing public health, I love that, because it gets at kind of the same sort of thing that the schools like to tout, that we have a very small student to teacher ratio, that you know, you can get individual attention. And in this case, they are getting the individual attention, and it's making a big difference, at least potentially, as it expands. It's making a big difference in their lives. And I know that public health people and also hospitals across the nation have tried to work on things to, I don't know, kind of check in on their patients or to help them stay in routines and help them adhere to, you know, medicine schedules and things like that. And it does work, and I think that's a wonderful thing for them to do. How well is it rolled out, I guess, in such a big setting? I mean, how many people are involved in this?
The
story I read, it was only like a few dozen people, patients were involved to start with. Theoretically, it would grow in size, but the issue now, I think, is a funding structure issue, because like EMS is currently funded by basically transporting patients for the most part to the ER, and that's where part of where all these like high healthcare costs come in for it. But ultimately, it'd probably have to be done at like a federal level or something to manage the fundings. But for now, these test programs could potentially save these services money by not having to staff as many trucks, you know, during peak times, because they won't have as many calls, theoretically, from these patients who call on a regular basis for routine things.
There's also, I ran across an organization that's been founded to advance this idea nationally. And it must have been part of the same story. I don't remember Houston in particular, but it seemed like a larger experiment and something that they were trying to promote as a way of delivering healthcare for the, 75% of people who don't live near urban centers.
Yeah, that's a very good point. We always, especially here at the Carver College of Medicine, we always talk about how rural populations can be underserved and that can, you know, decrease their access to healthcare. And even EMS is slightly, you know, less available in rural areas. You're less likely to have, like, paramedics. You might have EMTs or something instead. But it'd be a great way to have routine, I guess, regular care far away from a hospital. You know, we've got
drive to get there. If they can get some, you know, statistics about how it works with regards to preventative medicine, I would think that a lot of people would want in on this, because preventative medicine is like the best, one of the best ways to reduce healthcare costs. It costs way less to stop someone from getting something than to try to deal with it afterwards. And it's also more effective. Like there are some things that once you have them, it's just, sorry, too bad. Like now we have to remove that organ or whatever. But, you know, if you can stop that from happening, if you can sort of keep track of people over time and help them manage their health, like that's a much more efficient and much more like people-friendly system. Like they'll have much better quality of life.
That's definitely true. It's a bit more big picture patient health than
long-term.
It is, you know, oh, they're having some emergency now, we're gonna go bring him to the ER, and then the ER will worry about what's going on right now, and we'll have to schedule him for something later. It's more what's best for the patient overall.
Yeah,
it's good.
All right, you want a story?
Okay.
I got one.
Tell me a story.
So there's
a story, Cole Chaney.
Basketball fans, they always know that anytime you get the big player, the big heavy guys, Big Baby Davis comes to mind from Boston Celtics back when they won the championship a few years back. There's always this risk. They get this weird, they get the plantar fasciitis going, and they get the heel foot problems. And it's sort of this, it's known, but no one really ever pinned it on something. And now research in Australia has shown that it starts in overweight children. So these overweight children are 4 to 5 times more likely to develop foot pain, strained foot, and even plantar fasciitis, which I realize is more of an infection, but it's sort of a byproduct of a generally unhealthy foot and the tendon that is running in the foot, in the heel. And so what this happens is then perpetuates a cycle where these children not only have bad feet, but then they can't exercise, and then the overweightness perpetuates, which then creates more foot problems. And so they're really encouraging now swimming and biking for these young kids. And it's sort of, you know, there's always been the go outside, run around, play football, play basketball. It's like, maybe this isn't the best recommendation. So now there's a new set of ideas of how we maybe help young overweight children, maybe prevent problems in the long run. Straightforward, non-controversial story, right? But interesting.
Because everyone has access to bikes, good bikes, and biking trails and swimming pools, I'm sure.
Yeah, not necessarily, but I mean, I think a public swimming pool is probably not too difficult.
And that's just good advice, you know, for any number of joint issues. They're both very low impact on joints. You know, if your knees are hurting, it's a lot easier to ride a stationary bike or a real bike than actually, you know, walking or jogging or running. Mm-hmm. Same thing as swimming as well.
Swimming, I feel like I'm not into it. I'm not very good at it. Mm-hmm. I feel like that always comes up as the like number one thing any orthopedic surgeon, any doctor ever. It's always like, do you swim? You should swim.
It's also super efficient at burning calories.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, awesome. And it works so many more muscles.
I prefer to be more clothed in my exercise.
Just get a dry suit.
La-ti-da,
Dave. It's not the clothes that I worry about. It's the drowning.
Are you not a good swimmer?
I'm like, I feel like it's not advantageous to my health if I drown.
Yeah, no.
So no matter how many calories I'm burning in the process.
I think you burn a lot drowning, actually.
Probably. Well, I feel like I'm not going to appreciate that as much as I can.
Wow. So this study was looking at, you know, overweight children as well. But yet we see a lot of these problems in, like you said, basketball players and athletes as well. So you know, is that just coincidence that they're, you know, doing higher impact stuff? Or is there an actual link that the study is looking at?
So their link was only with children.
Okay.
So did not extend, although they said these people are much more predisposed to later life problems. But I think most of us could have ascertained that. And it's also tough because, you know, for example, a professional athlete, I'm guessing Big Baby Davis, despite being a very big man, is also amongst one of the more physically fit people you'll ever meet.
He's been injured a lot, as I remember.
His always foot
Especially
and ankle
like
issues.
First couple of years, he sat out a lot player? Of it. No, he's a big basketball player.
But he looks like a football player, and that's sort of why he got the name.
Well, he's a giant, and he's running around, smashing his feet against the floor. You know, he's going to get in.
Yeah, this also reminds me that my alma mater, Drake, played New Mexico State, and they have a pair of brothers on their team, both of whom are over 7 feet tall. One of them, I think, 7'3", and the other 7 foot. And each one has got to be, I think, near or over 300 pounds. It's incredible.
Wow.
So that's always the freaky, because there's one thing where there's the really tall guy, the Yao Ming, or the, you know, it's weird when they also are proportionally big.
Yeah.
Shaquille O'Neal comes to mind that, like, if you had them next to a gigantic car, you wouldn't be able to tell. Like, you could tell Yao Ming is so narrow,
oh,
right?
Like if somebody there's grabbed like, them off like both ends and just stretched them out.
Yeah.
They just pick up a Fiat 500 and carry it around with them just for the heck of it. No, so you know, they are very inclined to joint issues as well, partially through development and partially through their sheer size.
Do these people that deal with, do the neurons like go all the way to the tips of like?
No, they just stop.
I can't go any farther. I'm done.
They literally get the transmission. Don't they
get
like a transmission issue?
So the transmission through the neurons is insanely fast.
The extra fluid is not.
But that's more myelination it needs. That's a longer distance that it has to keep going. So I mean, there is some sort of delay, I would imagine. But
and tall guys
not
never
noticeable.
Live very
Microseconds
long.
Microseconds.
Doesn't
of
that make you wonder
time?
How giraffes work?
You ever wonder, man?
Sitting around late at night,
like
guys,
in general,
how do giraffes work?
Oh my goodness. I have something.
Let's hear it.
Everyone knows that men engage in riskier behavior than do women. But what about idiotically risky behavior? That is behavior that is so unencumbered by intelligence that it results in the perpetrator's removal from the gene pool. Everybody knows, I think, about the Darwin Awards.
Yes.
Well, the British Medicine Journal looked at the Darwin Awards from 1995 to 2014 to see if they could draw any conclusions about sex differences in moronically life-threatening behavior. Why hasn't this been done before? Idiotic risks.
This research.
Idiotic risks are defined as senseless risks where the apparent payoff is negligible or non-existent, and the outcome is often extremely negative and often final. So, for instance, shooting yourself in the head because you were demoing that the gun really isn't loaded is not an example of what the researchers call male idiot theory. But shooting yourself in the head because you were demonstrating that the gun really is loaded qualifies.
I don't know.
How does the first one not qualify?
I feel like the first one should qualify, but maybe in a quantitatively different
way. That is a class of uniqueness,
way, but
the second example
it's
is
an order of magnitude.
A whole new class. Yeah. That's what sets it apart.
It's valid.
It's not marginal by any means.
Of the 318 cases, 282 Darwin Awards were awarded to males and just 36 to females. So sex difference is highly statistically significant. Sex difference may be a result of socio-behavioral differences in alcohol use, though. But why? Why do dudes do this?
Isn't it a peacocking thing? A symbolism? A way to express?
I don't know if you can express your amazing fitness to reproduce by destroying yourself. By doing something that's obviously going to destroy you.
But performing amazing feats.
Right? It's a thumping your chest extrapolated a trillion times and turned back on itself.
In the name of all reproductively fit females in the world, I say nay.
The evolutionary explanation would seem to say that this confers some selective advantage on those who do not become its casualties. But if you shoot yourself in the head with a loaded gun to prove that it is loaded, I don't think you've accomplished your goals.
You've removed yourself.
Chlorine in the gene pool.
Inevitably, some people do jump into the gene pool when the lifeguard is not looking.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting.
All right, I have a more science-y one here. Removing clot. I thought we'd do a little med school science.
You do med school stuff, and then I'm going to go back to a weird one.
Yeah. So when you have a clot, okay, you're at risk for a stroke, coronary artery disease.
Well pronounced.
Yeah, I'm working on it. So that one of the classic ways to do it is there's actually these clot buster drugs. You put them in, TPA comes to mind, tissue plasminogen activator, I think. Mm-hmm. And it busts up the clot. Very easy way to do it. You know, it's well monitored in the hospital setting. But there's also certain things you can do, like place stents, or you could also actually go in and physically remove the clot. There's surgeons that are qualified to do this, and depending on the severity, it might be required. Swedish study shows that, or pardon me, Netherlands shows that mechanically removing the clot actually makes you significantly less likely to have a stroke than using this drug that busts the clot, which to me almost seems counterintuitive, because you would feel like they'd maybe leave a little bit, or you'd maybe not get the correct clot, right? Because this TPA is ubiquitous throughout your body, as opposed to the mechanical clot is removed at a certain point.
So this is something that I actually have thought of before. Like, if you, my question has always been, you know, so you squirt some TPA in and it starts to dissolve the clot, but what if it doesn't
dissolve it quick enough?
What if it breaks it up into smaller pieces as it dissolves, and then, you know, those bits go all throughout your body and mess you up?
That's a real problem.
That can happen, yeah. That's a thing.
I mean, I suppose the risk is the same as the risk is of that particular thing is similar as if you go in with like a morcellator and.
But you could do one fell swoop theoretically if you could. I mean, yeah, you're right. There is always the risk, but I think the surgeon might be able to get a cleaner grab.
And if it's being vacuumed up by the surgical device, then I guess the risk would be smaller. I don't know. That's
I feel
cool.
Like threading a catheter through your I guess it's arterial. Be more likely to knock something loose. So that's what I'd be concerned about, just like intuitively.
Sure. Yeah. And then the research, I mean, so it's just, you're significantly more likely to survive. Or pardon me, I think what do? An ANOVA test or something? You compare the two means and you have a better survival probability following a mechanical removal. And it's also
how many means were there? How many different things did they do?
I can send you the study. So this is a very broad stroke.
If it was two means, it's a T-test.
Okay, there we go.
analysis of variance is
it's on the boards. I need to know it, so it's sad I don't.
It is important.
I also think it's funnier too to sort of take a step back and look at medicine. I think as pharmaceuticals get much more advanced, there's always this sort of, it seems to be where things are going, and so this is sort of an original method to remove a clot, and it's funny that we're sort of reverting back to something maybe we had once come from. You know, that's progress doesn't always mean better in some situations, which I thought was interesting.
That transitions semi-nicely into getting to the very root of human nature.
Okay.
Now, a few weeks back, actually, it was probably last month by now, I told you a story about a rugby player who had gotten so many broken noses that he hadn't been able to smell in years. He didn't do plastic surgery. He continued playing rugby, got hit in the nose, and immediately saved a bunch of people from a gas leak. So, there's recently been a study looking at why are we able to discern good versus bad smells? And is there actually a neurological basis for that within our brains?
So like binary?
In a way, okay. Yes. So looking at the brains of flies to start the study, they found that there's actually another region outside of the olfactory bulbs, which is basically where you smell things moving right into the brain. There's another part called the lateral horn that's about the same size, but it has a similar, you know, like you said, a binary system to where it either flashes if it's good or bad or strong or weak.
I want to do this with children and foods.
Somebody remind me to keep my children away from this.
So through this, they're wondering if, which makes sense if you think about it, it is beneficial to know if a smell is good or bad. Is there now actually a neurochemical basis for that? The problem is we don't really know what causes one to light up versus the other. But the fact that it does means that there is some way, and that is what we have to figure out. So it's intriguing.
There's at least an association.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And this always affirms when the advice, if you study light a candle, or if, you know, studying different environments to get a different smell, and apparently that will really imprint a memory. Mm-hmm. It sounds like by activating a different part of the brain, this sort of, you know, confirms what they've
said.
Yeah,
and so fun fact, if you ever wondered why that is, that when you smell something, a memory immediately comes to mind, that's because the proximity of the olfactory bulbs to the memory-keeping places in the brain, so the hippocampus and these structures that specialize in your memories. And that is the sense that is most closely tied to that. So if you think about it in distance travel, that has the least distance to travel before it reaches your memory centers.
Yeah. Wow. If you think
unless
about
your big baby whatever is
big baby David.
Your neurons are so long.
Exactly.
Yep.
That sounds like that old game show, like, his neurons were so long. How long were they?
What's your story?
Okay, my story. It's super random.
Okay.
So basically, some scientists found out that most mammals, larger than rats, take approximately 21 seconds to pee, despite varying bladder capacities.
So I gotta think about this now.
5-milliliter bladder of a domestic cat versus...
Cole's like rewinding in his head.
I don't think I take
Hang on just
seconds.
A second.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't see animals on this list. I see cat, Great Dane, and African elephant, but I bet we fall in there somewhere. I don't know. I want to know now. I think it has to be at full capacity. So if you really want to...
Oh, man, definitely 21 seconds.
Listeners, let us know by visiting theshortcut.com how long it takes for you to pee.
As well as filling out the tech survey.
Please tweet us. No, an African elephant, which has an 18-liter bladder.
Oh, my God.
Also takes 21 seconds. Man,
see, that's like a pressurized fuel hose for a race car. You've got to get that in there quick, as opposed to trying to fill up a squirt gun where you've just got, you know, the faucet on just a little bit. That makes total sense.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know who funded this study. I don't know why they did
it. Is this how long it takes before they start urinating or before they empty the bladder?
I think it's start to finish like.
Just
want
to double check.
So, yeah.
I've noticed... The urgency with which I have to urinate does not correlate at all to the length of time that I urinate.
Interesting.
Well, okay. Have you ever noticed
that? Study on that.
Sometimes it'll go forever, and you're like, you really didn't have to go that bad. And other times, like, if you really, really have to go, and you're like, oh my gosh, I have 18 liters of, like, elephant urine. And it kind of doesn't take that long.
That might be part of the urgency right there. I've
never had the feeling of having 18 liters of elephant urine. Please tell me what that's like.
I want you to think about that maybe next time that you really have to go, or another time, a more moderate time.
Okay.
I don't think they're connected very much, weirdly enough.
What I'm wondering is, what is evolutionarily special about that 21-second number? Is that the amount of time that it takes somewhere out in the savannah somewhere to hear it, and then figure out where it's coming from, and then start running at you to kill you?
I don't know. That makes perfect sense, though, because why would everyone else, if there's different volumes and yet the same time, it would have to be your theory. I don't know why else,
because, you know, if you tend to have a lion in your family that goes, you know, longer, then they're more likely to be, I don't know, killed by a lion or something when they take a leak. But if you are quick and efficient, then you live. I don't know.
This is very interesting.
Man,
apparently,
this is the most important thing we've ever spoken about.
34 different species, the numbers don't lie. That is how
it's
many
Fibonacci sequence
they
of urine.
Have they said what they're going to do next then to you know, next step in this research?
I don't know. Apparently it has to do with the maybe the size of the ureter. Yeah. So
that's fascinating.
It says that there are differences in the urethra. So not ureter, sorry. I misspoke.
I have a quick med school plug here. The biggest confusion for urinary neuro issues was always relaxing the bladder versus contracting the bladder. Because if you think about relaxing, like, okay, I'm relaxed, like, now I can go pee. And that's not how it works at all. It's opposite, right?
Yeah, no, that
By constricting
sense.
It, that was always like a big stumbling block for me.
I'm sorry. What?
So if you, by a by innervating the bladder, a relaxed bladder will hold urine. And so you will not feel urgency. As opposed to a constricted bladder is squeezing urine out, and so you will feel urinary
urgency. Like a balloon.
Urgency, like a balloon.
Except it's
a
muscle.
And I always associate the emotional feeling of, I'm very relaxed, now I'm relaxed and I can urinate. And that's totally not how it works.
Do you have that, like, public pee fear thing?
That's a real thing.
That is a real thing.
They got upset recently over
The Rob Lowe commercial. Where the meek Rob Lowe said, you know, I can't go when other people are in the room.
Yeah,
and they thought there's actually a group that's like their cause. They're the Shy Bladders of America or something. And they said this is really, not right.
I'd like to see that on your
they
resume.
They are making this look, you know, funny, and it's not.
You know, the more time goes by in my life, the more I realize that I don't take myself seriously enough. There's not enough that I can get offended at. I don't know. I suppose there are implications of not being able to pee in public that I just don't understand because I don't have,
But once you do, it'll take you 21 seconds.
It's true.
Hopefully. Right.
Only if you're full. My roommate in college, actually, I don't think she was actually, like, sort of publicly shy, but whenever we were in the shared dorm room, they're like, bathroom, she would turn the sink on full blast.
Oh, that's a common thing.
And then go in the bathroom, and I got mad at her because I was like, you are wasting so much water. And so I would go over and turn it off, and she started turning the shower on because I couldn't get to it. To turn
smart.
It
well.
Fine, waste the water. I don't care.
Mm-hmm. We're at the end of our time.
Aww.
So thank you guys so much for joining me this week.
Thank you, Dave.
Putting a nice end to the year, to the semester.
Oh.
We'll talk to you in the new year. If you liked what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcode.com. Do follow us on Twitter so that we can stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. This show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producers are Dave Etler and Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. And our opening theme music is by Dude Skywalker. Our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.